There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 382. It's Comic-Con week. We have one day left, of course, of the Force at the time I'm posting this episode. So if you go to starwars.com/Course of the Force or youtube.com/Nerdist, you can see highlights. You can see us raising money for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. And thank you if you participated. And at Comic-Con, I'll be moderating a ton of panels. So I'll be running in between things. But definitely say hi if you see me frantically running the Comic-Con floor. If I am running, I'm not running from you. I'm just running to something, which is probably a panel that I'm moderating. Like, we are having a Nerdist panel that will be Saturday the 20th, Saturday, July 20th at 3 p.m. in the Indigo Ballroom over at the Hilton Bayfront. And then the rest of the time, most of the rest of the time, I'll be on Hall H. But I'll post the full schedule on Nerdist.com. Our show with Matt Smith at the Balboa is sold out, which is awesome for us. Not great for you if you wanted to go and you didn't get a ticket. I apologize, but it should be super, super fun. We had a Doctor Who person on every year for the last 3 years. We had Behrman on last year and then Matt and Karen on the year before. So I'm... Who knows what will happen next year? Oh, Matt's leaving. And I miss that bow-tied, adorable hug muffin. So I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, Stamps.com. Don't drive to the post office. Why would you do that to yourself? Do you hate yourself? It's possible you do, but you shouldn't hate yourself that much to go to the post office. Stamps.com has everything you need at your computer. Print out the exact postage you need. Stick it on your envelope. The post carrier comes and takes it away, and you never have to get in your car or walk to the post office or stand in line or wait at a crazy machine or get yelled at by someone. Stamps.com will do everything for you. Right now, there's a no-risk trial. It's a $110 bonus offer and up to $55 of free postage. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else that might be postal-related. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist at Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. This episode is Jeff Bridges, and I have to say, we've probably done about 400 episodes of the podcast, and I got a little nervous. I'm not going to lie. So it just goes to show you, no matter how long you do something, you still get a little nervous sometimes, which is good because that means you care about what you're doing. And I did care about this, and Bridges was awesome. So we were just like tucked in this tiny little conference room on the Universal lot. As one may expect, I believe this took a philosophical and existential turn. He has a new movie called The Rest in Peace Department, RIPD, which is based on the Dark Horse comic that opens Friday, July 19th. So go see that. It's sort of like a ghosty Men in Black. So please enjoy the Nerdist Podcast number 382 with the delightful Jeff Bridges.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
You're gonna do live improv. They're gonna give you a scene and an occupation.
There you go. Yeah, right.
You got Ry Ray.
Jeff Bridges, it's an honor to have you on the podcast.
Wonderful to be here, man.
Have you done a podcast before?
I think I have. Yeah.
This is not so. This is not your first podcast.
I wouldn't say it's my first podcast, but I don't know how is a podcast different than like a radio show or something. Is there any difference
it's
as far
less
as
important?
Less important? Oh shit! Well, I'm out of here. Then. Can you swear? Can I say
yes? You can
words?
Fucking
I can
swear.
Oh man!
Shit, fuck balls. Anything you want.
Pick one.
Anything
pick
you want. Yeah. Visit. Then it's going to turn into Actor Studio. Is like, what is your favorite?
Yeah.
Have you done Actor Studio?
I've done Actor Studio.
How was it? How was James Lipton?
James was great, man. He was great. I, of course, immediately comes to mind that wonderful impersonation of him by Will.
Oh, yeah. Like,
It's so great.
Will's great because it's like it's sort of like those Dana Carvey impressions where it's like he didn't quite nail the voice, but he just nailed the essence of it.
Oh, it's so wonderful.
Huge stack of cards.
Yeah.
How has it changed for you? I mean, like, is it the movie making? Is it still, do you still love it? What does it feel like for you now?
It's so much part of my life that I experience, you know, the gamut of emotions with it. You know, you get your ups and your downs. It's a little different these days. You know, there's a lot of green screen, blue screen acting, you know, which is a bit, while it's more advanced, in a way it's more primitive.
Sure.
Because it calls upon all of those skills you had when you were a kid pretending. You know, you don't have any cool costumes or, you know, you're acting in a leotard with a bunch of glowing dots on yourself. You know, you've got to imagine, you know, everything. Your surroundings, you know, your props, you know, the other person, you know, what they're going to be like, and all of that. So that's a little different these days. You feel more and more. You get more and more of that. You know.
I think about people who are in acting. So people who are like in the new school, like, you know, and they're taking acting classes and they're studying. They're trying to find the center of the character. But I imagine at no point in theatrical training are they like, today we're going to put green leotards and dots on you. And you're like, how am I supposed to?
I bet they will start doing that. I never thought of that.
Acting for 21st century film.
I would imagine.
Green box theaters are going to replace black box theaters.
Yeah, when we did the first Tron, it was, you know, very primitive. We shot it in 70 millimeter black and white. The whole thing was tinted by hand.
Yeah.
With some ladies in Korea, you know. All the vector lines, those were just adhesive tape on a little, you know, black Duvetine stuff. And this last, Tron 2, I was literally scanning to the computer. It felt like it was, you know, the movie, the first movie, but it turned real, you know. And they, you know, scanned us in. And like I said, it was a lot of acting in, leotards with golden, you know, glowing dots. You know?
Well, Tron is, I mean, that was a movie for me that is always, I mean, and I'm sure a lot of people say this to you, but that's one of those movies that I watch that movie every year. I'm like, oh, I got to watch Tron again. And I went to a double feature in Santa Monica. It was Tron and Khan. It was Tron and Wrath of Khan. And Steven Lisberger was there.
Oh, right.
And all these effects guys. And they said to everyone, like, you don't understand. We didn't have an application. We just plugged this shit into a computer. It was all math formulas.
It was so funky. It was before laptops. I think it was even before cell phones.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, God. Now, RIPD... You know, the special effects in that are another number completely. I don't think I ever wore a leotard with glowing dots on RIPD. There's a lot of, you know, now, you know, the cool thing, I think, is to do some of the old school, real practical, you know, stunts and marrying that to these, you know, the newer technology. And how can you do that as seamless as possible?
Yeah.
We were really fortunate on RIPD. Robert Swanky, our director, was really skilled at doing that, marrying that old school, you know, stunts and stuff with the new technology to make it really seamless and put you in the world.
That's good.
Yeah.
Because you worked on Seventh Son, and my girlfriend's dad, John Dykstra, did the effects for that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And John says today, he's like, my job's fine, but mostly I'm just standing behind a bank of computers. Like, it's not like the old days, like in Star Wars, where we went into a warehouse and just built shit with our hands.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. It's very different now. But you still get some of that, the old school, you know, that stuff. It was wonderful working with John on Seventh Son. He was did some terrific stuff.
Have you worked with them before?
No, it was the first time.
When you're sort of looking around at, like, because I would imagine you could probably do whatever you want. What is it about a project where you go, yeah, I think I could bring something to this? Like, when you have unlimited choices, how do you know?
I do my best to not engage in projects. I find my impulse is to kind of push things away because I know, you know, what it takes. If you do that, you're not going to be able to do this, and you don't even know what this is that you wouldn't be able to do if you do something. So I try to push things away, but the thing that really kind of hooks me, being a movie lover myself, is to be surprised, you know, to go to a movie and not know what to expect and then get your mind kind of blown. You know, that's kind of what I like.
Yeah.
And RPD is one of those things. I remember, you know, reading the script. I mean, how are they going to pull this off? This seems so incredible, you know. And then you find out, and you start to, you know, get into it a little bit more and find out who's going to be in charge, who's at the helm. And it was Robert Swanky. He did the movie Red.
Mm-hmm.
You saw that.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And I was really impressed. You know, that was kind of a genre film, but he took it to a, you know, another level, I thought. And he seemed to be a good guy, you know, to be at the helm of this one. And then to hear that, you know, Ryan Reynolds and then Mary Louise Parker, and as they started to assemble the cast, Kevin Bacon, you know, it was very exciting.
Is Ryan Reynolds as dreamy in person? Like, that guy is just like, he's not human, right? He's not human.
He's a pretty dreamy guy. Yeah.
I remember seeing him on the cover of, like, Entertainment Weekly, where he was like, I don't know why everyone thinks I'm a sex symbol, and he's leaning up on a shower, and he's got like a 12-pack. Like, come on.
Right. No, he is really terrific. Such a you know, he's got great humor, you know, he's, you know, wonderful comedian, he's got the drama thing going, got the, you know, the bod and the action stuff. He's, you know, very very physical actor.
Yeah.
Canadian.
That's always a plus.
he gets points for that.
Exotic.
I mean, this is basically your entire life has been the entertainment business, essentially. Did you ever think, like, could I just be a banker? Could I just, like, not? Was there ever a point where you thought that?
Not a banker.
Well,
that
not
never
a banker.
Crossed my mind.
But just like something, just like a regular guy job.
Something in the arts, you know, music. I've always been attracted to music or painting, you know, something like that. Something that involves some kind of creativity. I guess banking does too. You can be a creative banker. There's a lot of creative.
There are a lot of creative bankers. That's why the country is in a shithole.
Part of the problem.
This is slightly too creative banking, but. You know, when you're growing up and you're a kid and you're in this entertainment family and your whole family do you felt like you had a choice to go into acting, or was it just like, no, I really want to do this?
Yeah, too? Probably not too much of a choice, man. I was brought into acting at 6 months old.
Wow.
My father was visiting a friend. John Cromwell was making a movie. And they needed a little baby, and I happened to be there, 6 months old. And my mother said, oh, here, take my baby. You know? And I was a very happy baby, and the baby in the movie was supposed to be, you know, a crier, you know, and crying in the scene. And the actress, I'm spacing out her name now, Jane, great actress. She was in the original Against All Odds called Out of the Past. Quick Google it.
Jane Greer
handed me over to Jane Greer, and my mother says, oh, he won't cry? Just pinch him. And they pinched me in the beginning of my acting career. Now we cut, you know, maybe 35 years later, and I'm in another movie with Jane Greer doing a remake of her wonderful movie with Robert Mitchum called Out of the Past. Mm-hmm. And our movie was called Against All Odds.
Yeah, huge movie.
And she was playing her character in the original movie. She's playing her character's mother now. And I went up to her and I said, Jane, I'm having a little trouble emoting in this scene. Would you please give me a pinch, baby? So we had fun with that. But no, you know, unlike a lot of actors, and particularly, movie guys in Hollywood, unlike them, my dad and my mom were very gung-ho about the biz. They wanted all of their kids to go into show biz because they loved it so much.
Yeah.
And my dad, you know, would always, you know, say, come on. And I don't know if you remember Sea Hunt. It was a TV series he had, you know, back in the early 60s. He would say, come to work with Dad. And I go, oh. And he says, come on, you get to get out of school, you know. Make some money. You can buy some toys and stuff. Come on, man. It would be fun. Pretend with Dad, you know. So that was like from the beginning. And it was kind of late, you know, took me a while in my career before I really decided that that's what I wanted to do. I was thinking of, you know, like I said, music or, you know, any some other kind of artistic endeavor.
And then you do Last Picture Show and you're like, ah, fuck, I guess I'm pretty good.
It was way after last. I had done maybe, you know, 10 pictures and I still hadn't figured it out.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think figuring it out means?
Well, in my case, I had just finished a movie called Last American Hero. I had a wonderful time. And usually after a movie, I feel like I don't want to ever make another movie again. You know, it spins a certain muscle, this pretend muscle or whatever you want to call it, and it kind of gets exhausted. You think, and fortunately, I've learned now that, you know, that desire, you know, comes back after a while, but... In this case, after Last American Hero, I was exhausted and didn't feel like working. And my agent called me up very excited and said, got a great gig for you. The Iceman Cometh, starring Lee Marvin, Robert Ryan
in it,
you know, Frederick March, this incredible cast. And I said, no, man, thanks, but I'm going to turn it down. He says, you're turning it down? I said, yeah, I'm bushed. And so he says, okay. And about 5 minutes later, the director, Lamont Johnson, from the movie before, called me up and just read me the riot act. You know, said, you call yourself an actor. How could you turn this down? You know? So I decided to do a little experiment on myself. And, you know, I understand that, you know, to be a professional, you have to do it when you're not feeling like it. And I certainly don't feel like it. So this might be the nail in my acting coffin. I'm just going to do it and see what happens. And I did it and had an incredible time working with these old masters. And John Frankenheimer, you know, wonderful director, shot the thing. And it was like, it's a 4-hour play. We basically worked on it like that play. We rehearsed it for about 8 weeks and then shot it for 2 weeks. So it was sitting around for those 8 weeks talking with all those other actors and, you know, learning about their feelings and finding out that their insecurities and their fears, that never goes away. You know, so
that never goes away.
He says, you know, that's, you got to get, you know, befriend that thing because that's going to be around probably for the whole time.
Why do you think performers have that? Is it because performers are extra, almost by design, sort of extra sensitive because you're basically trying to re-express the world? And do you think that just makes you more sensitive in general?
I find I get more anxious when it's something I really care about. I really want to pull off, and I hope I'm up for it. You know, I hope I can do it justice. You know, and I guess sometimes I get the image of a wide receiver going out for that long ball and just say, oh, let me catch it,
Are you pretty hard on yourself, or are you a pretty easygoing? Because I think your public persona is more like the dude, where everyone's like, oh, Jeff Bridges, he's probably, like, everything probably rolls off that guy. He's, like, the easiest, you know, do you think that's really you, or is there a place where you're, like...
It's the gamut of emotions, and people think the dude is all this laid-back guy, but that's not really, not the way I view him, you know. I mean, you know, when the stranger asks him, how's it going, dude? You know, strikes and gutters, man. Ups and downs. The dude gets plugged in just as much as anybody, you know. Piss on his rug and find out what happens, man. You know? But he deals with stress. We all deal with stress. It's... you know, how we do it. Stress isn't necessarily a terrible thing. It's uncomfortable, for sure. But it can lead you to some cool places if you just kind of hang with it, you know, cook with it a little bit. It's tough, though. It's challenging.
I feel like a lot of what our culture is about now is about not ever being uncomfortable. You know, with like, you know, with drugs and distractions and prescription medicine and booze. Like, it's just like the internet is like, it's constantly like, I don't want to feel uncomfortable for a second. And I think it's kind of important to feel uncomfortable.
It is. And how to, you know, kind of groove with that a little bit and see what goes. It's a tough challenge because, like you say, that relief is so available to us, you know, in so many ways now, just to hang with that stress and let it kind of do its work and be with that. I find that really challenging in my life.
You know, yeah.
How to do it.
Do you ever get, because you obviously, with some of the movies that you wrote, especially with, well, even with like Tron or even you know, more dramatic, like Fearless or Lebowski, it's like you really have to put a lot of trust into a director, especially with like the Coen brothers, where it's like they're doing something really specific. Do you come in with ideas, or are they like, well, this is really kind of just how it is, and do you play along with them in that way?
Yeah, the way I like to do it is definitely come up with my ideas. I can't help that, you know, as I read this thing, I have all kinds of ideas and write all that shit down and present that to the director. And I love it when a director is you know, very inclusive and wants to hear what you have to say. And Coen brothers are certainly like that. They really, you know, you want all the stuff that you got. But there's a lot of ways, you know, directors, you can have directors that don't want to hear what you have to say, you know. Thank you, Jeff.
Right.
Thank you for your wonderful idea. And then they do. And that's, you know, and that's, you can make some great movies that way, you know, with some directors. It's not the most fun way to work, but I've worked that way and gotten, you know, good results. But I usually like to kind of empower the director, you know, when I, you know, go in, you know, say this, you know, if I'm, you know, like I say, I try to resist the project as much as I can, but when I finally engage in the thing, I try to give it up to the director, you know, because it's ultimately not always, this isn't always the case, especially with these big movies that seem to be really making a lot of these days. But for my money, the director is the cat who is in charge and who the whole thing is going to get funneled through, you know. So you're really, in my view, I'm trying to create the director's vision, you know. And that also takes me away from my own concepts about what I'm capable of doing, where I see it going, and so if I can kind of turn it over to him and let him direct me, you know, whatever.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, right.
That is a really interesting idea, because I think most people probably think of acting as like, oh, it's a thing that's in your own head, but the idea of getting out of your own head and just being like, you're the conductor. So
it's terrific, and I bring all my stuff, and I'll constantly have, you know, ideas, but you know, turning it over to him is makes it a lot easier for me. You talk about the stress and the pressure.
Yeah,
that takes a lot of that off me. You know, because he's the guy. He hired me. You know, he's responsible for the thing, for the vision, and I'm gonna there to serve him and get him out. And you know, most often they'll say, you know, what are your ideas? You got any ideas? I say, yeah, let me try one of the things. It could, you know. And that's one of the things I love about directors is their ability to be a good audience, you know, to see, yeah, to be thrilled with your, you know, what everybody's doing and everything.
But it also means that you have to pick directors that you absolutely trust.
Well, yeah, but you never know. It's always like leaping off, you know. It's like taking a leap of faith, because there's so many opportunities for a movie to get screwed up
that have nothing to do with you as a performer.
Or the director, you know. A lot of times it can be taken away from the director, and the suits will say, no, I've got a good idea, this is the way it should be,
right?
And the director said, yeah but no, who has the final cut? Look in your contract. So you can work on a movie for, you know, 3 years and have it all, you know, pulled out from under you. It must be terrible.
Have you ever been in a situation where you're at a premiere of a movie and then you see what ended up happening and you want to sit up and go, guys, I did other takes than this.
Well, for me, it's very, you know, I can't really get a clear picture of a movie that I've been in when I first see it, because it's, you know, it's like watching a home movie. You know, you remember all the, like you say, all the other takes and, you know, what you had for lunch and the conversation you had with that guy. You know, and so it's, and that's, you know, stays in your head, so you can't follow the next scene because you're thinking of that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's I've got to see it, you know, three or four times to really get a clear picture.
It almost seems unfair that, you know, that people write reviews of specific performances where you go, this actor did this job or this actor didn't do a good job. It's like, oh, but there's so much more. Like, you know, there's so much more to the formula. Like, maybe they didn't use the right take, or maybe it wasn't, you know.
Oh, one of my favorite kind of favorite and worst experiences all rolled into one was doing a movie called 8 Million Ways to Die that Hal Ashby directed. And his approach was so bold. He had such, you know, wonderful art balls, man. He would just, you know, show up and assemble his actors, and the script was literally just kind of a sketchbook, and then he would go off and say, what do we feel like doing? You know, like, but you got to look at the pudding that, you know, came out of his oven, you know, by this method. And this, my brother Bo did his first movie, and I called The Landlord, and I did his last movie. And it was Andy Garcia's first movie, and we had a wonderful time working with Hal. He was so great. But this producer, you know, had no respect for him, fired Hal, didn't let him cut the movie, and then proceeded to just cut it against the grain.
No.
And just, you know, and that's just so painful, you know.
Yeah.
But you got to, I guess, I don't know, this is my take, I got to be willing to go for it and not care so much about the results, but just be into the process and working with all these wonderful people, you know, because like I was saying, there's so many opportunities for it to, you know, fall off the table and not be what everybody hopes. And the reverse is true. Sometimes it turns out, you know, like we mentioned last picture show, you know, God, that kind of thing just kind of stands alone. It's just like amazing. It transcended certainly my expectations, but probably everybody else's that was in the movie.
Yeah. When you look back now, do you feel like you've learned most of what you wanted to learn, or do you feel like, ah, shit, there's still a lot I just don't know?
Yeah. Kind of both. You know, you learn stuff. You learn that, oh, I guess I'll always not know shit. You know, I guess that's, you know, that's kind of what the takeaway is.
That's an important admission to make, though.
Yeah, yeah. And just and being innocent and being willing to be innocent and being willing to give it up. And, you know, you hear a lot of actors are kind of protective. So if a director will suggest something, they'll say, I'm not going to do that because that's probably going to be in the movie, you know. I find, you know, I really try hard not to take that road because that limits everything. You know, you never know how it's going to turn out. I just give it up, do my best, you know.
Yeah. Do you have a concept as like, you know, because most people is like, ah, Jeff Bridges is this very famous actor, but you're a guy, you're a person, and you have thoughts and feelings, and do you see the difference between those two, like this persona and then the person that you actually are? Do you have like a piece carved out for yourself?
Get into that a little bit more, ask that some more.
I'm saying, like, you know, when you're about as famous as you could be to the world as an actor, like where you have been for a long time, do you still feel like there's a piece of yourself that's like, this is just for me, and the public thing is a separate, kind of a separate guy, like a separate mask that you put on, but at home you're really just or do you feel like they're the same, you know, you are what you are?
I am what I am. I'm a, you know, it's the Popeye thing.
Yeah.
I am what I am, and there's certain probably things that time I spend in with the toilet that I don't share. I haven't done a shitting scene yet.
No. Nope.
One second, let me think. I might have. Well, actually, I stuck my head in the toilet, didn't I? But that really isn't shitting.
No, it's not. I do think a shitting with Jeff Bridges' web series could be great, though. It's just whatever you think of in that 3 to 8
That's
minutes.
Right. Maybe it could do like me and my brother Bo in a two-holer outhouse. What do you think, Dale? Huh? Just kind of carrying on, you know. But you know,
burning bridges.
Yeah, burning bridges. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Light a match, will you, bro? Come on.
I'm sick of lighting your matches. That'd actually be a pretty good. You and your brother, I was some of the stuff that I was reading online, you were like, that, you know, it was really you guys have always sort of had this relationship. It seemed like he looked out for you a lot when you were growing up.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, he's my, you know, my best friend, my mentor. And we had such a great time doing Fabulous Baker Boys together. That was a great... I say, you know, talking about directors, I've had such wonderful luck with first-time directors. That was a first-time director, directed Fabulous Baker Boys, Steve Clovis. And we had such a great time, gosh, on that movie. That was wonderful. We're always looking for something, you know, as good as that. It's hard, you know, so not just to cash in on the brother gimmick, but to find something that's, you know, as good as the Baker Boys, you know, something really good.
Yeah. When you were working, when you would go to work with your dad, did you feel like, oh, this is how we bond, this is how we're bonding? Was it always through like acting and performing?
I never thought that, but we did a lot of bonding that way, you know. I can remember when I was a kid, you know, and him and you know, I finally said, okay, I'll do this part in the sea. And I did a few sea hunts as a little kid, and him, you know, sitting me on his bed and teaching me all the basics of acting, you know, all those things. I didn't think at that time, oh, I'm bonding with my father.
Right. You
know, I didn't think of that. But later on, I guess I did, kind of later in his life, we did two films together as a, you know, when I was an adult. And that was really cool, man. We really had a great time because, you know, acting, for me, basically, it's kind of, you know, advanced pretend, you know, like playing when you were a kid, you know, playing pretend. It's quite a bit of that, you know, involved, except you got all the cool gear, you know, unless you're doing the thing in the tights and the balls. But anyway, with my dad, the first movie we did as an adult was with Coppola, you know, Francis on Tucker, and Francis is like a big kid. There's a lot of kidness in him. And the first thing that he said on the second week of rehearsal, he said, okay, now everybody, got everybody in the room and said, now we're going to shoot the entire movie in this 1 week. Vittorio Storaro, our DP, he will use this wheelchair as a dolly. You costumers, if you need a wedding dress, look at these drapes. You can take that, you know. And you actors, when we do the car scenes, make sure when the car stops that you give a little, you know, thing like that. And I'm going to be shooting, we'll do all these cameras. And it was kind of like, you know, the Little Rascals. You know, come on, let's make a movie. Come on. You know. And what we didn't know was that he shot the whole movie that week. And what we didn't know is to and from work, he was editing the whole thing. And at the end of that week, he gave everybody a copy of the film and said, now we've made the movie, here, we're just going to polish it up a little bit. Huh. And it was wonderful because for a couple of reasons. One, you know, when you're making a movie, you don't shoot in order. You know, you shoot kind of out of order. So in this version that we did that week of rehearsal, we shot everything in order. So we got to experience the story that way. When you're an actor, when they put in a camera, you kind of rise to the thing. So you've got to, you know, really, you know, give it your all as much as you could. You know, sometimes you had to just read your lines off the script. But it was that sense of play and playing with my dad that way and hearing my dad say, hey, I got an idea. What are, you know, and feeling like that, you know. And that was a wonderful thing. We worked again in Blown Away. It was another great, great time of playing together.
I just find that I think, you know, my relationship with my dad got a lot better as I got older. When I was a kid, when I was younger, he kind of had his own things that he was focusing on. And, you know, my dad was a professional bowler, and so he was on the tour. Uh-huh. And so, but when he got older, he became very like, let's just hang out and bond, you know? And I wonder if that, is that what happens when you get older? It's like, oh, I just want to bond with my family. And
I guess there's a sense of that, you know. You know, I notice it in myself as, you know, as I'm feeling more, you know, my mortality closer to me, that I want to, you know, do the important, you know, be as close to the ones who are most important to me, my family and stuff, and engage. I always like to try to find things that I can do, it's sort of in the work realm with my kids, because that's kind of, you know, as you get older, you know, you probably experience this too. This is kind of play. What we're doing here, this is how, you know, come on, Johnny, you want to come on over? We're going to get the mics out and pretend I'm interviewing you. It's, you know, and here we are, you know. So with my middle girl, Jessie, I'm going on tour with my band here in a little while. She's going to be opening for me. She's been my assistant in the last three movies, so we just hang all the time and play a lot of music. My eldest daughter, Isabel, we're writing a children's book called Daddy Daughter Day.
That's sweet.
And Haley, my youngest daughter, she's got a store, and she's invited me to come in and draw on the walls and stuff. So we find, you know, ways of, you know, playing together like that.
That's nice. I mean, I see your website's fun because it basically just kind of it just lays everything out. That all the stuff that you work on and the photography.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
You get great photography shots, I think, because you're you. And I think most people, if anyone else like lifted a camera in a room with Robert Downey Jr. and like John Favreau, they're like, put the fucking camera down.
Exactly.
And I was like, you can take all the pictures you want.
That's one of the reasons I do it, is because it is such a unique point of view, you know. You mentioned your dad's a golfer.
He's a professional bowler,
Professional bowler, a golfer. And that reminded me of bowling in Lebowski. And maybe you've heard this story. I don't know. It always cracks me up. I thought you might enjoy it. The dude, by the way, has never seen bowling in the whole movie. Do you realize that? In Lebowski, you never see him bowl.
No.
But we being, you know, John and Buscemi and myself, we took serious bowling lessons, you know. And we had this master bowler, I can't remember the guy's name, but he was like right up there, top guy. And he had an assistant with him there, and he was teaching us. And I was asking him, gee, what do you think the dude's wind-up would be? You know, how do you think he would prepare? You know, and I don't know, this might be a little bit before your time, but do you remember the Honeymooners?
Of course.
Remember Art Carney?
Yeah.
Remember how he would always do, you know, when he would sign a piece of paper, he'd take, you know, about 5 minutes and to kind of warm up his arm and everything. Russell, I'm going to go back again! So I thought, is that how the dude would be? You know, like, you know, wind up like that. And it's when I start to say it, the guy's assistant goes, and he laughs like this.
No.
And I say, why are you doing that? And he says, nothing. Like it. And I look at the master bowler. I say, what is going on? He goes, oh, nothing. And the guy keeps laughing. I say, oh, come on, you guys got to tell me. And the master bowler says, well, you know, in bowling, it's kind of like Zen in the art of, you know, archery. You know, the pins are down. Even before you put your hand back, you've got to have the mindset and everything for that. So I would, you know, get into that mindset, I would, you know, have to, you know, get loose, and he would, you know, shake a certain thing, you know, and kind of get my mind empty, you know. And it would take, you know, 5-10 minutes, and like Lisa and, you know, all the guys in the bench would say, get out of the head, boy! You know? So I said, what happened? He says, well, man, I had to go to a shrink. I had to stop. I could not throw the ball. And I went to a shrink and, you know, spent a year in there figuring out what's happening. And so I say, so what's your method now? What do you do? He said, I throw the fucking ball. I just get up and think, and I just start thinking about it, just boom, you know. But ask your dad, but you must have bowled.
Right? I still bowl.
You still bowl. So you kind of get what that guy's saying, or what do you?
Yeah, my dad, when he sees me bowl, he goes, you do what I do, which is you run up there because you don't give yourself time to think about it.
Oh, that's it, man.
Yeah.
See, that thinking.
I pick up the ball and I fucking go.
That thinking is tough, man, isn't it?
It is. But not just with, you know, it's so interesting that, and it sounds kind of dumb, but basically to take something like bowling and then go, but you could really apply this logic to life. Like when you get too, like, oh, should I do this? Or what if this? Or what if I, like, you're trying to coordinate 1,000 muscles when you really just need one.
You can never get enough information, man, you know, to make the right choice, right? I'm going through that stuff now. I can't. It's tough. But it's something about that. We want to make the right choice, right? I heard a good slogan the other day that rang my bell. You can never get it wrong because it never gets done.
That's interesting.
Isn't that kind of cool? You know, you're always kind of learning and applying what you learn, and keeps going on and on.
Well, I always tell people, you know, when they say, oh, I want to start something, but I don't know what to do, I go, well, start it, and then if you fuck it up, then do it differently the next time, and then you learn something, and then you're better off.
That's right.
You know, don't be afraid to fuck it. Don't be afraid to throw the ball in the gutter,
yeah,
basically.
That's right.
It's not the worst thing in the world. I feel like, I think one of the reasons, and of all the movies you've done, and I think, you know, The Dude is so iconic now, and Lebowski, and I know you've been to Lebowski Fest, and Lebowski fans are fun, and I think it's just because, I really think it's that guy just really is just kind of a metaphor for, I'm just a person who has a very simple set of tasks that I want to complete to stay happy, and the rest of the world will not fucking leave me alone to just complete those tasks. Is that how you see him, or what do you think his thing is?
Yeah. Well, it's that same thing we're talking about, stress and comfortable. You know, the dude really is kind of addicted to comfort, as we all are, I think. But, you know, look at the groove that the... you know, look at the great story that came out of the dude's stress. Yeah, look how the strangers showed up, man. You know, it's hard to separate those discomforts from feeling like, you know, this isn't the right thing. You know, this isn't it's not happening right, but. You know, what would it be like if it was only a groove? You know, if there was no shit at all. I don't know if the groove would be a groove. You know, what would it be? I guess it'd be dead, maybe.
Maybe, or maybe just, I think people that don't have, where there's no struggle, sometimes they're a little shallow, because they don't, it's like, oh, everything's really easy. So yeah. There's no, like, you didn't trip and fall on your face a bunch. You're not scabbed over, so everything's like, oh, yeah. You know.
Yeah, or maybe it's everybody's got their own versions of struggle. Like that person, you know, that's a struggle to be. That's a different kind of struggle, you know, to be locked in that way, you know.
Yeah,
it's a struggle no matter what, man, isn't it? I find shit.
No matter what you're doing,
no matter how much you get it together, you know, the universe will look. Oh, you got it together. Check it out, man.
Yeah,
throw you some of this to handle, you know, or you're feeling, you know, big and open, and then you say, well, there's this that. And you get too big, you know, and then you get dampened a little bit. And that's, you know, sometimes if you're like the kind of person that you talked about that isn't too, open to change and struggle, you know, even just a little tiny bit of it, like you, that advice that you were giving your buddy, you know, well, just go in, you know, do a little thing, you know, don't have to feel you got to do the giant thing, just a little stretch, see where that is, and... You know, sometimes it's too much. Sometimes it's, you know, just enough to feel, I did that. That was great. You know, and that it leads you to the next thing. But it's got, life's a bitch, man.
Well, it's like someone, you know, like a friend of mine says, sure, you might get all of this one thing that you think you wanted, but then everything kind of goes up. And so then, you know, the stresses kind of go up.
That's
too. It's
right.
Like nothing,
yeah.
No thing makes everything easier.
So it's kind of like what we were talking about with the acting thing, about the fear, you know, learning that doesn't go away. So it's how you befriend that and how you kind of work with this thing that's going to be there. It's not about getting rid of that thing. You know, it's not about getting rid of the stress, but how you dance with it, how you play with it and laugh at it, you know, and let it also lead to how connected we are. We're talking about stress here. This is something that you experience, I experience. That comes with this kind of like a camaraderie. We get a little more community. Yeah, we're stressed, man.
Yeah.
You know? What do we do? What should we do? You know, how do we get out of this thing? Do we want to get out? Do we want to get deeper? What are we going to do? What's up? You know?
Yeah. Do we use it? Do we let it, you know,
yeah.
Is it step on our necks?
Yeah. But everything we can work with, all that stuff. You know, it's the thing that where you shut yourself down, where you get, you know. But sometimes you got it. Sometimes you just, you know, it just gets too much, and you got.
Well, yeah, especially. I mean, I would imagine. You know, is it weird when you're, you know, when you do something like Jagged Edge, or you do a character that's a little off? I mean, that character doesn't think he's off. But are there? Do you connect with characters when you're portraying them? You're like, I don't really know if I want to keep this guy with me once I'm done with all this, because it's a little, you know, a little weird.
Yeah, I remember doing an interview at home, and the interviewer asked me a similar question. You know, are you the kind of guy who likes to be called by your character's name, and you take the character home with you and stuff? And I think I was right around when I was doing Jagged Edge.
Yeah.
And I said, no, not really. I'm not really that kind of actor. And my wife was in the room, and she let out a big guffaw. I said, why do you say that? She says, well, you don't think you take it home. You know? But I guess I do, and I'm not even aware of it. You know? But I think I do. You know, you take all those things in.
I want to talk a little bit before we let you go. If people go to your website, there's like all your music is there. And by the way, I think that was... When you did Crazy Heart, was that sort of for you going, hey everyone, music is something that I do and that I enjoy, and I know you've released albums in the past, but was that for you partially sort of a coming out with your music to the world as well?
Yeah, I guess that was a big byproduct of the thing. You know, I mean, we were talking about stress and anxiety and stuff, and in that movie I was kind of particularly anxious because, as I mentioned before, I get most anxious and stressed when I want to pull something off that I care about, you know, and I really wanted that music to be great. And, you know, my dear friend T-Bone Burnett was in charge of the music, and the great first-time director, Scott Cooper. And by the way, wait till you see his new movie. Gosh, Out of the Furnace. It'll be coming out soon.
Okay.
Killer movie.
All right.
Anyway, you know, with the music, so it was a dream. I just hoped I could pull it off, and it turns out I did. I did pretty good. I pulled the sucker off, and then after the movie, I thought, well, now, you know, if I ever wanted to explore my music in a deeper way, now's a good time because it's kind of, you know, out there that I, you know, play music, and so I got, you know, a band together and take it out on the road, and so that was, you know, that was a wonderful thing to happen.
Where do you feel the validation? Do you have your own sense when you watch a movie and you go, yeah, I did exactly what I wanted to do, or is it other people going, that was amazing, or is it holding an Oscar in your hand? I mean, like, when you're just looking out of the theater and you're like, well, I have this award, so I think I did something right.
For me, it's how I feel about it, you know, and then I guess next would be the people that I respect, their opinions. But for me, when I'm watching a movie, it's almost like a red light, green light thing. I say, yes, you got to off. good. And, you know, and like the dude says, you know, that's just your opinion, man. You know, the opinions aren't really worth much, I find, you know, in my life. I'll often, you know, acting, I'll do a scene where I think, oh, man, I kicked ass on that scene. That felt great, you know. And then I'll go see the dailies, you know, or see it in a movie, and I'll say, what the hell was that? That's terrible. You know, it felt great because you were kind of in a cathartic place, but it doesn't serve the story, you know, it's totally inappropriate for the thing. And other times the director will say, we got to move on, and I'll say, I've got a better idea, I can do it better, and he says, no, we got to move on. I go, okay, you know, move on. And then you see it and you say, oh, that was fine. That's so these opinions, you know, this is, I think, one of the things that causes us a lot of stress is our opinions, not about so much out there, but about ourselves and what we're like, and these opinions, you know, we just shouldn't take them too serious.
I just, the one thing, and I'm guilty of it too, that I just wish people would do is just be nicer to themselves. Like, you just get so fucking mean to yourself.
Oh,
like, oh, I didn't do this, or I didn't do that, or I didn't, it's just that.
Oh, man, it is so tough, isn't it?
In sort of wrapping up, I want to talk a little bit quickly about the End Hunger Network, and because I was digging around your website, and I saw the letter that you had written about, you know, the post that you made about, like, hunger has to end with policy, with government policy, not just here's a sandwich. Like, the government has to institute policy for change.
Yeah, that's very important. Also, it's utilizing the policies that are already in action and out there. I'm the national spokesperson for an organization called Share Our Strength and their No Kid Hungry campaign. And that's all about going from state to state, working with the governors, trying to have them make ending childhood hunger a priority in their communities. And that's not by, you know, getting more programs or raising more funds or anything. It's about using the federal programs that are already in place. But if they're not used in those states, then that money goes somewhere else. So it's letting these, you know, the folks know that there are programs available, not only in the schools, like, you know, like the breakfast program and the lunch programs in school, but summertime is a very tough time for kids who are in need of food because school's out. Most of them get their nutrition at the school, and when the school's out, so are those meals. But it's important for everybody to know that there are meal sites all around. And if people want to know actually where these sites are in their community, they can and help me with this because I'm not a texter myself. But there's a text program, Food for Kids. Text Food for Kids to 877-877, and you can find out where these meal programs are in your area. And if you're 18 or under, you can get, you know, free food at these places, and there's no paperwork to fill out. That's a big thing that turns a lot of people off who are in need. They think, oh, I'm going to get,
right,
you know, busted something or something's going to happen. But there's no eligibility rules. Just show up and you can get something to eat. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I would like to drop a challenge, which is we do this thing on the internet. I do a show called All Star Celebrity Bowling. We've bowled against Breaking Bad cast, Mad Men, Conan, Mythbusters. I really feel like we could get a Lebowski team to bowl against, we could break the internet. We could fucking break the internet.
How do you mean? What do you mean, man?
I mean, you and Goodman and Buscemi and me and a couple other people, we bowl for charity. We could raise money for the End Hunger Network. We could fucking break the internet bowling in one bowling match, like one, just uniting you guys.
So now, where is this shown? Is this on your?
It's on YouTube. It's on our YouTube channel. We do it for charity, and I really feel like I've got to drop the Lebowski bowling challenge right here, right now.
All right, well, I'll talk to my teammates. And see.
If you do it, they'll do it. Like, but it's been really great to have you here.
Good
sharing
with you.
And thanks, man. And Rest in Peace Department is July 19th. Thanks, man.
Good chat.
Really good chat with you, too. All right. Enjoy your burrito. Would you mind telling everyone to enjoy their burrito? That's something we say at the end of the podcast.
Now you've crossed the line.
Oh, shit.
Now you have crossed the fucking
line. Oh, my God.
I'm not a burrito man. I don't believe it. No. What do you want me to say?
Just tell people to enjoy their burrito.
See, now I'm taking direction now. This is a good example of that. See, I'm trying to go beyond
Jeff,
my...
I want you to, you know, really reach down and remember the first burrito that you've ever had.
And what is the line again?
It's enjoy your burrito.
Enjoy your burrito.
Cut, print, we got it. One take, Bridges.
Very good. Cool. No, we've done this before. Haven't we done this before? You look so familiar, but you must have been on TV.
I'm
stuff.
On TV. I'm on TV a bunch. Maybe.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels?
There are murders in all of the books.
That she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.